I think what it is that there is more of a verticality in the black community. You know, black community traditionally has been almost totally horizontal. I mean, in the social structure, you know. There was, of course, always a small middle class and a small, you know, upper class, bourgeoisie. But now I think that pimple has grown just a mite larger. And I think because of that, there are more obvious class tensions, you know, within that black community.
Blacks, politics, and art, next on Soundings.
The principal purpose of our voyage was not simply to gather the flora and fauna. That was my personal preoccupation. Rather, our mission was to explore and chart uncharted waters. To that end, the crew of the Beagle would drop a weighted line to the bottom and record the depth at regular intervals. The measurements were called soundings. They told us where we had been and would serve to guide those who followed.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, listen now to our program called Soundings. Thoughts and ideas about the present and the future with an appreciation for the past. Your host is Wayne Pond.
The National Humanities Center is pleased to present a conversation with Emiri Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones, about blacks, politics, and art in contemporary America. Emiri Baraka is professor of Afro-American Studies at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. He's the author of numerous collections of poetry, nonfiction, and drama, including plays such as Dutchman and The Death of Malcolm X. Joining in the conversation is Thomas Cripps, a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center, professor of history at Morgan State University, and author of books and articles about blacks in American drama and film. Here is Professor Cripps.
The interesting thing about your what amounts to a long life's work now, not many people start as young as you have creating something that other people want to see or hear or review. That's a remarkable accomplishment. But I was noticing in that Soller's biography of you, he speaks of you as a modern populist, and I was wondering whether he ever mentioned that term to you and what that whether that has any meaning at all to you politically.
When I was young, even though that existed, see, I guess the black middle class is peculiar in that they can live, because of the kind of national oppression that black people live under, they can live in the same street, in the same block, next door to the poorest people in the neighborhood. You understand what I mean? Because it's, you live in one community. I mean, at least back in those
days.
In the old days. Now they're starting to sort of
suburbanize
a little more. But in those days, it was a little more horizontal, you see. And even though, you know, when I went inside the house, there was a different, you know, kind of regimen going, kind of middle-class regimen. Really, when you were out on the street and in school and in the playground, the kind of ethic and aesthetic that I was always drawn to was, you know, the black mass aesthetic. In those situations, you always had some of the little black middle class kids who would be isolated from the majority, from the masses on, you know, on the street. But I never, you know, was particularly interested in that. You know, I always wanted to relate to the majority, to my peers, to the people that I felt were, you know, who were the strength, you know, of that community in a real sense, you know.
What was it really that got you writing, that got you thinking, and did you get angry? What was it? Can you remember a specific time when you look back and you said, well, I'm going to write about this?
Well, I think the question about writing was a decision that I, you know, finally stumbled into. I don't know. I think I started writing in high school because I was hanging out with two boys who wanted to be writers, you know. One was wanted to be a sports writer, and the other one, I think, ended up being a detective story writer. So I took a writing course. But I never decided to be a writer until after the service, I think. I started writing poetry in the service, obviously because there was nothing else to do. But in terms of saying the things that I wanted to say, then that becomes clearer over in time, you know what I mean? I mean, as it comes out, then more and more you see you have certain themes, you know, you begin to understand certain things, things that you are saying, you know. But in terms of the populist thing, that comes from even being, as a young man, always wanting to be connected with the majority. I'm talking about black people, because those are my feelings, were always with the popular majority, you know. So then as you get older and you begin to see specific things that you know hurt them, you know, oppress them, harass and humiliate them, you see, then that does bring up a kind of gorge, and then you find yourself saying more and more. But I think that it was not until Dutchman became some kind of cause célèbre, when it became, you know, when I found out that I was going to become well known, you know, then it struck me that I had a responsibility, you know, to say something. Before that, it was sort of just whatever I wanted to do was what was happening. But once I discovered that, hey, look, people are going to know your name, you know, people are going to ask you questions, people are going to want to interview you, then a real sense of responsibility, I think, began to shape me in another direction, too.
In a way, you know, this is almost, well, if there's such a thing as a lucky break, this is one, in the sense that the stock cliche American writer is the guy who writes the Pulitzer Prize winner first and then does nothing for the rest of his life. Or starts at the top, and each novel thereafter is succeedingly
steps
less.
Away from it.
Yeah, but you spoke immediately of seeing a theme running through your work, and that's a kind of privileged position in a way. I think that you have a sense of a continuity and a line.
Mm-hmm. Oh yeah.
In this very country, different. That's one of the luckiest things very for a different. Writer. It makes it that. That's not to say that writing is lucky.
Well, see, I think the problem with writers, the ones you were describing before, is that sometimes there's one story they have, you know, and if it happens that they shoot it out in the first, you know, the first gasp, then that's it. But I think the thing about my own, you know, attention to, say, the theme of my perception of black life in America, for instance, and really the struggle for consciousness of society itself, is that I always see in retrospect how far away from saying that exactly like I want to say it. You see, because I think your perception always, if you were like alive, you know, you're always developing and changing and finding out more. And as you find out more, I think you find out how much more you have to find out.
What about black consciousness today compared with, let's say, 1967, Newark Black Power mm-hmm. Conference, Gary, Indiana Black Power Conference? Then it was so central to life to make everything black, mm-hmm. that is, white clearly was an irrelevancy. Mm-hmm. In fact, the white people with the, well, you referred to in one poem, the jelly faces and so on, there's a white image that is not less than relevant. It's mm-hmm. so contemptible, and the center of life is the Black Power Conference and so on.
Well, I think that, you see, that's well, it's a question, really a question that needs to be answered in depth, but I would say this, that that whole, say, movement in the 60s was at one level, you know, because of the context it was coming out of, because of what the 50s were, say, you know, the 50s, which begin as McCarthyism, you know, and the New Criticism, and the Cold War, and Eisenhower, and generally, you know, super conservative backwardness, you know. Now, out of that, you know, sort of like a dialectical kind of shot in the other direction is the civil rights movement that comes shooting right out of that, you know. And as a result of that, in some ways, because a lot of those, for instance, those veterans coming back from Korea and so forth, they didn't want to hear anything, you know. I mean, after they had been, you know, driven up and down, you know, the Korean Peninsula, they didn't want to then come home and somebody say, no, you can't go to this school.
Yeah.
You know, or no, you can't have that job. So then you get a tremendous kind of energy and dynamic coming out of the kind of dead 50s, You know, by the end of the 50s, I mean, 1954, you got even the rulers of this country responding to it, the desegregation thing. And then 55, the bus boycott, you know, in Montgomery. And the whole middle class gets out in the street marching, Dr. King. But see, by the time you get to the mid-60s, a lot of the promise that the black middle class was laying out in terms of the civil rights movement, by the time you get to the mid-60s, that's been repudiated. The March on Washington in 63. What happened? 64, they blow up a church and kill four children. The long, hot summer, you know, the three civil rights workers, Cheney and Goodman. So that there is another kind of energy and a Malcolm X that appears on the scene that creates a total alternative to that. But I think you have to see that the black movement was actually decimated of leaders by, 1968?
Yeah.
And not only the black movement, but one whole sector of the white liberal movement, let's say, led by the Kennedys.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, between 1963 and 1968, you get four people sent to eternity, you know.
And of course, the survivors of that class leading the country into another foreign war
Well, that's sort of the total like disillusionment with that whole period. But King, Malcolm X, John Kennedy, Robert Kennedy, and the countless numbers of others, so that and then on top of, I mean, that's one level of it, the whole decimation of the leadership of the movement. On the other hand, there were some people who actually who are supposed to have created the promise. You know, they become the mayors, the first mayor of this, the first mayor of that. Yeah. They become congressmen. They become the first black to sit on this board and so forth. But by the 70s, people are saying, so what did we get out of it?
Yeah.
You know, the great majority is saying, okay, so it's the first mayor of Newark, you know, which we, of course, helped elect. But then by the middle 70s, people are saying, so what did we get out of that? I mean, there may be, you know, okay, a couple hundred people who have good jobs now, you know, $30,000, $40,000, $50,000 jobs, but what did we get out of that? So then you get a real deep sense of disillusionment combined with this actual decimation of the leadership that leads to a kind of void and by the end of the 70s, you know, a kind of, well, where do we go from here? Where are we? You know, and so I think that this whole period of the 80s, you're seeing a kind of regrouping, you know, a refocusing, the development of new leadership, clarity in ideology.
How have blacks reacted to this artistically and in poetry and drama? Your work, for instance, what kinds of directions has it taken?
Well, I think again, see, by the end of the 70s, I think a lot of us saw that the publishers were actually pushing, because see, when you don't have your own publishing companies, if you have, say, 30 million people, and they have no publishing companies, with maybe two or three exceptions, it means somebody else decides what has to, you know, what is published. So we start seeing a whole development of work that was, say, less struggle-oriented, you know, that did not relate to, say, the writings of the 60s and early 70s that talked about, you know, the black struggle and you know, attention to black history in Africa and those things, you know. You began to see a writing that developed where people would say, well, my poetry is in and of itself sufficient, that it doesn't relate to anything but poetry or life in general and so forth.
From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, you're listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation. Here again is your host, Wayne Pond.
Soundings is pleased to present a conversation with Emiri Baraka, formerly known as Leroy Jones, about blacks, politics, and art in American culture. Emiri Baraka is the author of poetry, nonfiction, and drama. His plays include Dutchman, The Baptism, Blood Rites, and The Death of Malcolm X. Baraka is professor of Afro-American Studies at the State University of New York at Stony Brook. and he's taught at Yale, Columbia, George Washington University, and the New School for Social Research. Joining in the conversation is Thomas Cripps, a scholar in residence at the National Humanities Center and professor of history at Morgan State University, where his research and writing focus on blacks in American film and drama. Here is Professor Cripps.
This is, as a country, is not a book-reading country, and blacks not only fit that pattern, but in a way accentuate it. There's not a massive audience out there.
Well, see, I think that, well, it's a complicated thing. First of all, reading never made it big most places in the world. I mean, yeah. I think by the time it's possible for most people to read, we would have gone to something else, I think, you know. I mean, as a mass kind of communication, information, teaching instrument. But the reading, I mean, I think the people, there are enough people, let's say black people, who would read the books if they were available. We just did a study at Stony Brook, you know, I directed this study of black literature. Out of print black literature. And you know, the average black book stays in print, you know, like a year, less than a year. And after that, it does not come back into print. And even the very, very well-known, the important, acknowledged important writers, let's say Gene Toomer, for instance, Cain, which is, you know, acclaimed all over the world, it goes out of print in the 20s. It does not come back into print until 1967.
In a paper.
For obvious reasons.
Yeah, oh yeah.
And
right.
It comes back into print through a bookstore that gets a temporary license from the publisher. And then the bookstore publishes the book. Then the publisher says, aha, you know, after 2 years, say, oh, this book's up. Then they bring the paper back into existence. Yeah. But you can, I mean, you would really be startled if you looked at the author's name. For instance, Margaret Walker's book, 1941, For My People, Yale Series of Younger Poets, is out of print. Yeah. You know, one of the best known Afro-American writers, women writers, that exist, you know. The book is out of print. Now, what we're doing in our study, we're going to publish the findings of this study. We're even going to write to these publishers and say, you know, que pasa, you know, why is this so? And hopefully even get other people to try to publish these works. But there is no doubt in my mind that those, certainly those black classics, that there is a steady yearly audience, a kind of, you know, I hate to use the term again, but I think a renaissance, I think another flowering of the black arts movement at a higher and much more mature level. No, so I think it's a healthy motion in the black arts movement, in third world arts generally. And I think that one of our priorities, obviously, is to, you know, the publishing, production, you know, readings, communication aspect, is developing those kinds of things with a self-controlled, you know, direction.
Yeah, well, there's one thing that interests me. I just, for years and years, I've been trying to learn all I can about a favorite of mine. That's Dutchman. Not so much Dutchman as a play, but your one shot at making it into a pop market was when they made Dutchman into a movie. And yet, as you know, they made a lot of wrong decisions, like the length itself. I think if I were making that movie, I would have come to you and said, we need 30 more minutes.
Sure.
And make a feature movie that would have played rather than the one that must have come in about 1 minute plus or minus of the actual play.
Right.
And I was just wondering whether you had any feelings about your work in another medium. Like, what would you have done if you knew then what you know now about filmmaking?
Well, see, I think what you're saying is right on it, because first of all, if we were going to make a film of Dutchman, really, I mean, if somebody was going to ask me, I mean, a lot of the things that they talked about, we would have seen. You know, when they talk about, you know, we're going to the party, we're going down the street, we're going in our house, you know, we're going to make love, we're going to do this. And I mean, we would see, you know, we would have to see all of these things. You know, at the same time, we would be on that train, you know, we would
maybe
still,
cutting away to these
yeah,
other things.
Yeah, oh, absolutely. Or, yeah, we would have to see a lot of that. And I think that would just enhance it. They're getting ready to do a film, you know, now that I spoke, they're getting ready to do a film of a play of mine this month, a play called A Recent Killing that was written in the summer of 64. And it was supposed to be done on Broadway, the summer of 64, because at the time, you know, Dutchman was still running, and Barr Wilder asked me to write a play specifically for Broadway. And I wrote A Recent Killing, and but interestingly enough, two of the actors that played in it then, who played two of the leads, was this white guy who played a young Jewish airman from the Lower East Side, and this black guy who were, you know, friends in the service. They liked the parts so much that since that time they have been trying to get this movie made, and they finally succeeded in drumming up the money. And ironically, they're going to shoot the movie on the same airbase that I was stationed on in Puerto Rico, which is now not an airbase. I think now some company owns it to do something. But it's still, you know, still got the strips on the, you know, the runways, the hangars, and the barracks, and all those things.
Now, what assurance do you have that this is going to be your play?
Well, I have a script, a screenplay sitting on my desk right now that I have to go home when I leave here and read to find out how faithful it is to the script. But you see, what I think, there are a lot of dream sequences in the play, you know. Because what I was trying to show was a young man who was threatening to become an intellectual, who life is stopped short by the kind of malice of what Air Force life was. See, and people didn't want to do it during the Vietnam War.
Yeah.
Because, you know, it says some things that were definitely contrary to what some folks wanted to hear. The guy, you know, says, well, look, I'm not going to, you know, I think a group of Puerto Ricans attack the airbase because the airbase, they want to extend the airbase through their town, which was a literal thing that happened in Puerto Rico. And so the people started attacking the planes, and one of the young boys in it says, well, look, I'm not, you know, he throws his gun down and says, hey, that's not my planes. I don't own those planes, you know. And, yeah, of course, he's arrested and locked up. Now, they didn't want to do that during the Vietnam War. And it's just beginning to come out now. But I until I read the script, I won't know how faithful it is. And I think they're going to cut away a lot of the dream sequences, which I tried to put in there to make the character more sensitive.
Yeah, well, there's a certain amount of that. You know, there's a kind of rule of thumb that's hard to play in film.
In film.
So you'll, yeah, get an argument, I can tell.
Well, yeah, there's a lot of surreal kind of images in it. You know, what I wanted to do is have someone who's so caught up in their own subjective, you know, own world of, you know, fantasy and daydreams, yet be in the middle of a really horrible situation, and finally one day somebody slapping him awake, yeah, and saying, look what you're in, now what will you do?
In that, this populist modernism, the business of, you know, either intellectuals or people in a middle class or bohemia or whatever, reaching a mass, is that possible now? And if it's possible, are you going to be a part of that?
Well, I think, yeah, it's obviously possible. I think my work is always intended to reach, you know, great numbers of people. You know, say it was less intended to reach great numbers of people earlier. You know, I think when I first started writing, I had a definite elitist tendency. But I've really meant the work to reach larger and larger numbers of people, I think, since the mid-60s. Obviously, if I could write a, you know, a weekly television show,
yeah,
I could reach the people that I want to reach, but even more obviously, you know, unless you're going to be selling termite spray and deodorant and automobiles, you're not going to, I mean, serious writers will not reach the television.
Yeah.
The fact that you want to reach a wide audience, does, mm-hmm, that mean, does that change your writing? Does that do something inside your mind when you sit down and you say, okay, here's something that I want to say? Do you back, oh, yeah, off from it any?
No, it's not a question of backing off. It's a question then of having to find a way to say it. But I think to me, high art is trying to say very complicated things in as direct, you know, and simple a way as possible. It's very easy to say simple things complicatedly.
Can you give me an example? Can you give me an example of something that you know, something that you care about, that you've tried to talk about in a way that you have said it that you think is effective?
Well, for instance, this play, I just wrote a play called Boy and Tarzan Appear in a Clearing that's going to be done in the fall off Broadway. And really what that talks about is neocolonialism, the fact that, you know, say the colonial powers can be driven out of Africa, but they can still control Africa through, you know, indirectly through, you know, sort of native agents. Now, on one level, that is a very kind of dry political scientist, you know, subject. On the other hand, that is a subject that affects the lives of millions and millions of people, and that they're very, very much aware of, because every day they have to labor under that. So the question is, how do you talk about something as complicated as that and put the words in people's mouths so that they talk about it the way they obviously talk about it every day in the real world, you know?
Yeah. So you're living in this country in 1981 believing that this is, it's all still possible, right? You can do it.
Well, I think my ability to do it is going to be limited because I'm being put into a situation. I'm in a situation of obvious limitations.
Yeah, I think I'm really talking about optimism rather than you personally.
Oh, no, I think that the work I think it's my job, responsibility, you know, whatever skill I have must be utilized to try to reach as many people as I can. Now, whether I'll be able to do that, of course, in many cases is beyond my own will, you know. But I think that ultimately there'll be no doubt that the work will reach a lot of people.
As you look around you, what do you see happening?
Well, I think this is a very dangerous and critical period in this country, as far as I'm concerned. I think that there's an obvious rightward motion, rightward tendency in the country. I think a lot of these things were happening under Carter, but I think Reagan's presidency consolidates that. I think these $37 billion in budget cuts not only is going to hit blacks and Latinos first and worse, but even people like artists, if they say they're going to cut 50% of, you know, of the endowment funds, you know. And I think also the country is drifting toward war.
Speaking of modern times, you know, the thing that interests me both in, say, 1967 and now is that for a black intellectual then, the struggle was often between different strategies, that is, black nationalism, the black middle class, black activism. They weren't your enemies, they were merely options of different strategies. But today, there is actually a black opposition. In the sense that, you know, the present administration has its blacks.
Yeah, but I think what it is that there is a more of a verticality in the black community. You know, the black community traditionally has been almost totally horizontal. I mean, in the social structure. You know, there was of course always a small middle class and a small, you know, upper class, bourgeoisie. But now I think that pimple has grown just a mite larger. And I think because of that, there are more obvious class tensions, yeah, you know, within that black community. But I think what does unite it and what does permit a united front is the fact that generally even the black bourgeoisie, if they come out of their condominium, you know, on Michigan Avenue without a sign hung around them to say, I am rich, don't mess with me, they're going to might suffer the same indignities as a black worker, but obviously it's easier to suffer indignities in a condominium than it is in a coal mine.
You've been listening to Soundings, putting ideas into circulation in conversations originating from the National Humanities Center. Your host was Wayne Pond. We're interested in your comments. Write to us at the National Humanities Center, Post Office Box 12256, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Director of the Center is William Bennett. Soundings is made possible in part by a grant from the National Endowment for the Humanities and distributed by the Public Affairs Broadcast Group, Los Angeles, California.
This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center, inviting you to join me for Soundings, the center's radio program. This week, Soundings presents a conversation with Emiri Baraka, poet and playwright, and Thomas Cripps, a scholar at the center and an authority on blacks in American film. Blacks, politics, and art. This week on Soundings.